All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back after some classic Steve Earle and the Big Block Dodge. And welcome to another section of Ghost Tracks. And tonight, we're not wandering too far off that course. The track in focus is none other than Chicago's Soldier Field. Soldier Field, you've seen it whether you realize it or not, because that's where the Chicago Bears play their home football games. It's a huge stadium. It seats 100,000. It's right there on the lakefront. It's on Lakeshore Drive there in Chicago on Lake Michigan. Very, very impressive facility. You can go to Google Earth and zoom down to street level and see it in the up front and personal. And even folks living in Chicago, not many know that it was once it was always a stadium. It was always the home of the Bears and other Chicago teams. It was even host of the Pan Am Games, I think, in 1959. But it was also a racetrack, a fantastic one.
Dirt or paved, Bobby?
In the beginning, it was cinder. It was cinder. I think it might have went from there to clay and from clay to asphalt. But in the track that everyone will remember was the paved version, which was, I think it was paved in 1946. But to give you just a little inside track in case you hadn't figured it out now, is what is all this Chicago Soldier Field, Tiger Tom, and all that? What is the connecting link between all of this tonight? And it's Tim started us off on it's the chase. The chase begins this Sunday in Chicagoland. So some of us, including myself, may erroneously think sometimes that what does Chicago or the Chicago area have to do with stock car racing? But the answer is quite a bit. I mean, it's got a rich history. It's not out of the question for as much as we may like to see it remain in the South, but for NASCAR to be in Chicago is hardly a new idea. I knew Tiger Tom and just from being a race fan, and I knew Andy Granatelli just from being a race fan, but my mom, long years ago in the early 70s, brought me home this little book. She found at the local drugstore one day, just on a paper book rack. I don't know if y'all can see it or not. It's Andy Granatelli's autobiography, They Call Me Mr. 500. If you've never read it, and probably have to find a copy on eBay or somewhere now, it's the absolute most entertaining racing book I have ever read, and it's a very accurate history of the Indy 500 up through from 1946 to like 1971 or two. But Andy, Chicago, Soldier Field, Tiger Tom, how does all that fit together? In the early 1930s, midget racing was just running wild on the West Coast. That's where it started. Midgets looked like miniature Indy cars back in those days, and the really sophisticated ones, the really fast ones, were Offenhauser powered Curtis Craft chassis. They ran in what was called in the A division. Everything else, which was not Offie powered, and that included everybody had an idea if I could make a midget motor, washing machine motors, outboard motors, anything that anyone could come up with, all of them run in the B division. And midget racing was such a phenomena. They were racing midgets on a national scale, every night of the week somewhere. I mean, in Chicago, there was multiple nights of the week, and the phenomena spread from the West Coast back to Chicago in the 30s. They started running the midgets at Soldier Field. It was not unlike Bowman Gray Stadium as far as the track around a football field. It just had a lot bigger seating capacity. It was still is a huge stadium, but the midgets became immensely popular after the war, and they attracted the attention of the Granatelli brothers. And that time they were very noted Chicago hot rodders, street racers. They knew as much about a Ford flathead as probably anybody in the world. And in about 1946 or 47, the Granatellis decided that they would get into the A division midget competition, running a Ford V860, which was just unheard of because that was a strictly an Offenhauser class, although it didn't have to be. But no one figured anything else could outrun them. But the Granatellis built a Ford V860, bought them a new Curtis Craft chassis, hired a heck of a driver to drive it, and was so fast in practice that the rest of their Chicago colleagues met them before the race and said, "You guys have not met all the requirements to run with us, and you are not legitimate to run, and we will see you later." They had instituted a rule that to keep the Californians from just coming in and cherry-picking the races, that any visiting driver had to run at least three prior races at Soldier Field before they would be eligible to compete for some of their national championship and big money events. The Granatellis, of course, protested that we're not from California. We're Chicago guys just like you all. And they still met a resounding no. Well, you haven't run the three necessary events, and you're out. Andy Granatelli, before he left, he said, "Well, I'll tell you all guys one thing. I will be back to Soldier Field, and the next time you will be working for me." And he went home and decided, being the natural-born promoter that he always was and still is, that he could make a race, he could create a racing circuit out of hot rods, which was basically cut down 23 Ford Model Ts and stuff with souped-up flatheads. They had there was quite a number of them just in the Chicago area to draw from. And he organized, with the permission of the promoter at Soldier Field, he got the permission that he could stage a hot rod race. The guy gave him a budget of $1,500. Andy said $8,500 later of his own money, they had the race, and 25,000 people were in the stands. They created a sanctioning body called the Hurricane Racing Association to organize these hot rod races, and the circuit took off like crazy all over the Midwest, Cincinnati, Milwaukee, Chicago, just everywhere. They were racing hot rods literally every night of the week, and the midgets began to succumb to the popularity of the hot rods. Granatelli, with his just an extra sense of the whole racing industry, realized at the height of the hot rod craze that wasn't what he needed to keep doing, and he immediately switched to stock cars. This would have been in the early 1950s. The Hurricane stock cars were going to run at Soldier Field, and run they did. I mean, it became a weekly thing, almost a nightly thing, just like the midgets and the hot rods had been. At one time, they drew a crowd of 89,000. They had 27,000 one night in the rain.
Goodness gracious. Good gosh. How big was the stadium? How many did the stadium hold at that time?
It would hold 89,000.
89,000, too.
I guess
yeah,
so.
Yeah, it would hold 89,000. Granatelli said as wild as all this was, everybody was making money. It was crazy. He was a promoter's promoter. He understood that people, at least in his opinion, came to the race to see action. They did not want to see a train race. They wanted action, whether it was passing, wrecking, whatever. And he would have at least a half a dozen of what he called booger artists in the race whose sole job was to wreck. God-awful flips, T-bones, crashes, everything. They were supposed to wreck. On his cue, he stood in the middle of the pit area on an elevated platform and run the whole thing. He would cue the announcer when to announce and when the wrecks would happen. And they had about a half a dozen ambulances. And every time there was a wreck, the driver had to crawl out of the car, get strapped to the gurney, and get in the ambulance. They had to. I mean, that was... sometimes, after all this was going on, the ambulance would be making its way from the crash scene. They would restart the race with the ambulance in the middle of the pack. One, a couple of ambulances made several laps with the cars one time, and for his grand coup d'etat promotional stunt, they were having a big stock car race, and the ambulances was going to be involved. He had a big wreck, but before everything started, he got an extra gurney and a dummy dressed up as a race driver, had a driver's suit on, sprinkled some ketchup on him. And so when he cued the wreck that happened, the big wreck calamity happened, the ambulance flew out there, got the driver, loaded him up. Unbeknowing to everyone, there was the dummy stretcher. The ambulance took off. The race engulfed them again. They shoved the dummy stretcher out of the back. the crowd was going berserk. Eight people fainted because the ambulance man acted like he didn't know the driver had fell out. He finally realized it, slammed her in reverse and flew backwards, run over the then jumped out, grabbed what was left of the driver, shoved him back in, made another lap or two before he got out of the facility. Eight people fainted. It was the all-time greatest promotional stunt of his career.